2 Samuel chapter 21, and also I'd like for you to get Matthew chapter 26 located. 2 Samuel 21, Matthew chapter 26. I want to personally welcome all you visitors here, some of who I know. It's good to see you, especially those folks that I already know. And it's good to have some new faces too. That thing with the balloon, you pray about that. You know, they're going to let them loose, do that from time to time, promotion. But in those little plastic bags, they have gospel tracts, and I was seeing some of them are over in the guest house. They got them in one of the rooms over there to wait until the service is over. And I saw that one of those tracts that they put in was, God's last name is not Dan. And most of you have seen that track. But can you just imagine some guy, you know, he's working on his lawnmower or something. You know, things aren't going real well, you know. Can't get it started, you know, and he's just changing the spark plug and the oil and everything else, and he's kicking it, rah, 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 and then, you never know, you know, what the Lord can use to get people's attention. I mean, talking jackasses and roosters and stuff like that, you know, why not? You never know what's going to happen. Now, I was in 2 Samuel probably months, or certainly months, maybe almost a year ago, and then we started, I guess not quite a year, because about November we started out in Luke, and because I wanted to get some things done before Christmas, and been in Luke ever since, and on Sunday morning. And I don't like unfinished business, but I'm here in 2 Samuel this morning for more reasons than just I hate an unfinished project. I do want to finish 2 Samuel, but tonight I'm going to be preaching from Luke, where I would have been preaching this morning. Because we're going to have about 20 visitors or more here. Well, there are 16 teenagers that Brother Milligan has contact with through the school or music camp. They're going to come and help us with this band for the send-off next week. And there's a lot of patriotic feeling and the desire to help and support the troops. And these folks may not know any young men personally going over there. And so the parents are more than willing to bring their students to church so that they can have a part in this band. And they'll be practicing tonight and then they'll be in the service next week. And so I really feel compelled to preach a gospel message tonight. And the one I could have preached this morning from there is more of a gospel message, much more of a gospel message than the one I will be preaching. And this passage has some application to this time of the year when young people are making decisions about their future, finishing up their high school or college careers and moving on to other things. I think some of what I say this morning is pretty applicable to that cultural situation. Now, in 2 Samuel chapter 21, we'll read the text from verse 1 to verse 14. And then we'll read briefly from Matthew 26. So there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, "It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites." Now, way of background, when the 12 tribes of Israel entered the land of Palestine, the Gibeonites tricked them into making an alliance. They were supposed to wipe out everybody, but the Gibeonites didn't want to be part of that, so they came up with a plan. And they came to Joshua and the leaders of Israel and said, "Oh, we came from a long way away. We're not from around here." Got to do something with this. Going to distract me the rest of the morning. So we're not from around here, and here's the proof. We got these old worn-out shoes. We come a long distance. See the mold on our bread? We had to travel a long way. And we'd like to make an alliance with you. We want to be your allies. And Joshua and the elders forgot to pray. They didn't ask God about it, and they made an alliance with these Gibeonites. And then after that was made, they found out, hey, they were just from around the corner. They're people they were supposed to wipe out, but now they'd made a treaty with them. And they should have been destroyed, but they successfully tricked their way out of it. And although the agreement was made because of deception, it still held. God wants his people to be men of their word. And Joshua said, "All right, here's the arrangement." And so having made that arrangement, they were obligated to keep it. So instead of being wiped out, the Gibeonites were spared. And their sentence was that they were, according to the Bible, to be hewers of wood and drawers of water. In other words, menial servants. They were going to be menial servants to the Israelites. The Gibeonites accepted the arrangement. It was preferable to being exterminated. And everybody lived in peace until Saul came along. It's kind of strange when you think about it. Saul was a man who spared the Amalekites. When God said, "Wipe out the Amalekites," he spared the best of the flock. and the best of the herds, and the best of the spoil, and the king, Agag. God said, destroy them. He kept them alive. And he turned and then mercilessly slaughtered the Gibeonites. Innocent people. People with whom they had a treaty of protection. And the whole thing was unsuspected, and it was unprepared for. And as far as the Gibeonites are concerned, Saul was, as they say there, a bloody man. And he had a bloody house, as we read in verse number 1. Now it's decades later, and we're near the end of David's reign, and there's a great famine that comes along. 3 years subsequently. It was 3 years, year after year. So 3 years running, not a year here, and then some relief, another year, some relief, but 3 years, year after year. And you know, whenever there's a famine, and we'll take that just in a general sense as some kind of a judgment, some kind of a bad thing going on, somebody needs to be asking why. I mean, again, I used to hear a guy on the radio, Jim Kirkwood. You know, he's a hyper-dispensationalist, kind of hyper-grace guy. And he always, you know, kind of mocked the idea that, you know, if you don't do right, if you don't live right, then you're going to get a flat tire at 2 o'clock in the morning on a back road without a spare tire and no flashlight in the rain. You know, and that's, you know, some preachers kind of give you that idea. But listen, if I was on a back road at 2 o'clock in the morning and didn't have a flashlight and it was raining and I had a flat tire and I didn't have a spare, I might be asking God, hey, you trying to tell me something? Now, maybe that's just one of those things. Sometimes life doesn't go your way and you got problems and that's all there is to it. You know, everybody's going to have some, and this is a sin-cursed world and we're sinners in it. And sometimes things just go wrong because things aren't always going to go right in a place that's under a curse. But I'd be asking the Lord, you know, is this because of anything I did? How come? If you had a problem as big as a famine that ran 3 years, you'd be asking questions. And when hard times come, by the way, they may not be for a particular reason, but it might be for a very definite reason. Now, if it's for a very definite reason, that might mean you can do something about it. Like repent. Like make restitution. And if you could do something about it, wouldn't you want to find out what it was instead of saying, I'm under grace, I'm under grace, I'm under grace, so therefore I don't need to change. Couldn't be anything but that. Couldn't be anything, couldn't be God trying to get my attention so I'll wake up and give up some sin that I'm happy with in my life. It wouldn't be God trying to get my attention so I'd start doing something I haven't been doing that I know He wants me to do. No, it couldn't be that. No, and anything but that. The capacity for self-deception in the human heart defies understanding. Verse 2, the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, nor of the children of the Amorites, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the children of Israel swore unto them, and Saul sought to slay them. Look at that. In his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah, not to God. In his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Now David did the right thing. He sought an answer, and he got an answer. Again, I wonder. David acted on his answer too, by the way. He said, what will I do for you in verse number 3? But I wonder, where do you break down? Do you seek an answer? Or do you not get an answer? Or do you get an answer? And when you get an answer, do you act on the answer? Or you just say, I'm not doing that. You know, there's some dangerous pitfalls here, by the way, that are enumerated. And this isn't really the message, but I'll just point them out to you. There's two dangerous things you want to make sure you're careful about in your life. Never make any vows you can't keep. Because broken vows, here's the danger of taking a vow. If you break a vow, you have to deal with the consequences, not only of your actions, which may or may not be bad things. Understand, if you make a vow not to do a thing, and that thing isn't so bad, then you have to deal not with the consequences of doing it, you have to deal with the consequences of the broken vow. You're a covenant breaker. And covenant breaking is in of itself a much more serious issue than sometimes the things that we do. It's when you do them out of covenant, when you break covenant to do some things. That's the issue. I know that that's strange thinking to our generation, our society. Everybody imagines their complete autonomy and their irresponsibility to everybody else. But you understand that when you join a church, you are in a covenant community. We have a covenant around here. Say, well, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. Well, then that's fine, but I think there's something wrong with breaking covenant, even if you do think it's all right to do it. Who cares about that? God cares about those things. Showing you right here, He cares about those things. Joshua made a covenant, and Saul broke the covenant. It wasn't even his covenant, but he was responsible for keeping the covenant, and he broke the covenant, and the reason why there was a famine wasn't just because those innocent Gibeonites had been slain, as bad as it was. It was amplified in its consequences because covenant-breaking was behind it. And the other thing you got to be careful about is zeal to impress the brethren. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Oh, you know, I messed up on that Amalek thing. Really looked pretty stupid. Here I am, you know, I got the best of spare the sheep, spare the flock, spare Agag, and along comes Samuel, and makes me look really stupid. I hate it when preachers do that. Don't you hate it when you're just doing fine and you're looking good, some preacher comes in and says something that really kind of points out you ain't nearly as good as you want everybody to think you were? He said, man, I got to make up for that. How can I make up for that? Oh, no, I'll show them. Hey, those Gibeonites, I never liked them anyway. I don't like the way they look or talk. They sound, they act funny. I don't like their clothes. I don't like their taste. Let's wipe them out. So he does. Look at me, man. I'm a tough guy. I maybe messed up on that Amalek thing, but I can definitely impress the brethren. And you know, when your motive is to impress the brethren, your actions are likely not only to be wrong, but probably too severe. I'll show them what a straight church we have. I'll show them what a separatist I am. I'll show them how hard I am on sin. You know, maybe you want them to have some zeal for God instead of zeal to impress the brethren. So David asked him, what do you want me to do? Verse 3. David said to Gibeon, what do I do? What do you want me to do? And I'm responsible. It's my office. I didn't do it, but I'm the guy who follows in the seat of the guy who did. And what can I do for you? Wherewith shall I make the atonement that ye may bless the inheritance of the Lord? Verse 3. And David is offering to make restitution. And that principle of restitution is as old as the human race. You remember what I kind of grew up in a rough background, you know, and everybody smoked. I mean, just everybody smoked. My parents smoked, my grandparents smoked. Not on my dad's side. My dad's side were godly people except for my dad. But everybody on my mom's side, you know, volunteer firemen, cops, blue collar people, rough, tough people, and everybody smoked. And I remember when everything you owned had a cigarette burn on it. You know, the funny thing about that is nobody ever apologized for any of that. You know what I mean? They're talking, you know, and dropped ash. Oh. You know? I mean, the upholstery of the car. I mean, I remembered that years ago. We were at one of these celebration stations or something, you know, where you crawl around in the mazes and all that. And we're standing in line. We just bought Amy a new coat. She's about, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 years old, something like that. I don't remember exactly. But we just bought her a new coat, and the lady standing behind her in line puts her hand down like this, got the cigarette, and it just burned a hole right in that coat. You know, and here's this preacher's kid going around with a cigarette burned. No apology, no, I'm sorry, no, hey, that's, you know, no, I mean, just, oh, well, sorry, you know, hey, I smoke and I got a right to burn things. I had that attitude too. See, I'm not just ripping at smokers this morning, I'm not, but did you understand that somehow that attitude of making restitution, it was just accept. If you hang around with people who smoke, you burn their stuff, they burn your stuff, it's an even trade. But that's not going to work here. It's not just a little hole that's a fact of life when you hang around with certain people. It's a serious issue. Make restitution. So they say, well, you know, verse 4, Gibeonites said unto him, oh, we don't want to be killed over this. We don't want anything. That's what they say. We'll have no silver nor gold of Saul nor of his house. Neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. And he said, what ye shall say, that will I do for you. In other words, what David is saying, they're saying, we don't want anything. And David says, yeah, you do. Why don't you just come on and say it. Just spit it out. I'll do it. Whatever it is, I'll do it. And they answered the king. See, they really wanted it all along. They just were afraid to say it. They answered the king, well, the man that consumed us and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any coast of Israel, if you insist, let 7 men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them up unto the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord did choose. And the king said, I will give them. See, David asks, he offers to make restitution. They say, we don't want to be killed over this, but they don't really mean it. They're shy about coming out with it. But he asks again, he insists, he says, tell me what you really think is appropriate. And they say, well, that guy committed genocide, just about, tried to wipe us out. And in the spirit of your insistence, here's what we'd like. David says, you can have seven of them, but you can't have Mephibosheth, because David himself had a covenant with Mephibosheth. And he wasn't going to break his covenant with Mephibosheth any more than Saul should have broken the covenant that was made with the Gibeonites. And by the way, we're under a covenant like Mephibosheth was. He's a picture of us, you know. We're safe. Amen. When it comes time to hang him out to dry, you and I ain't going. Amen. Because our David, our great king, has already made a covenant with us and said, not him. He's off limits. He's bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. I mean, we're one with him. We're in the Father's hand. You can't have that one. The king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. But, verse 8, and here's a problem text we should address before we get in the message. But the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni, and he made suits, and Mephibosheth, and the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite. You say, well, wait a minute. I remember reading over there where God struck Michal childless because she rebuked David when he rejoiced out there in the street. Remember, we had a sort of a Holy Ghost Baptist fit out there in the street, you know, and all those proper dignified people said, ooh, we don't like that. And Michal kind of had a complaint. Ooh, you made a fool of yourself today. And she's struck and barren, childless, died childless. She said, well, hey, problem text. Contradiction in the Bible. Michal had... No. It says, the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai. Now, if you check that out, look it up in Concordance, you'll find out that Adriel married Michael's sister. Michael's sister's name was Merab. And so Adriel, the dad, and Merab, the mom, had a number of children, and five of them were raised by Michal. Because she didn't have any of her own. She couldn't bear children. And so, for some reason, I don't know exactly why, it may be that they had plenty and were willing to farm some out. It may be she patronized them. Maybe she adopted them. Maybe she was maybe Merab was an unfit mother. I don't know. But these things aren't hard to answer. Again, you go to a secular university and take philosophy, you know, and they're going to attack the Bible. And one of the things they say, here's a contradiction in the Bible, you know. And they're going to point that out. They're not going to explain. It's easy to explain. And so there's Saul's sons. Anyway, two of them, he delivered them. The two of them were, of course, the children of Rizpah. And then the other five were the ones that Michal raised. And he delivered them in the hands of the Gibeonites, verse 9. And hanged them in the hill before the Lord. And they fell, all seven together, and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of barley harvest. So that would be late summer, early fall, somewhere around August, about the time the grain starts coming in. And Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock from the beginning of the harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day nor the beasts of the field by night. And it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. Now you understand, these are not little children. These are grown men. And so this woman, Rizpah, is an old lady. And we have a contradiction here in Jewish law. Jewish law required that a man who was hanged be buried at sundown, but this isn't a matter of Jewish law. This is a matter of Gibeonite custom and Gibeonite culture. And so, because that was what the Gibeonites required, their bodies remained there in the trees month after month after month, from the time of barley harvest until, if I'm reading the text right, when the spring rains come, that'd be about 7 months. Seven bodies for 7 months, left to rot in the sun, lifted up as a dreadful memorial of the justice of God and the vengeance of Gibeon upon a broken covenant. Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth, spread it, and so forth. In the face of all that brutality and barbarity and cruelty and bitterness and horror, there shines a jewel of kindness and virtue. There, Rizpah, in her grief, looks over the dead bodies of her two sons and her five nephews. every day for 7 months. Verse 11 says, "It's told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, which had stolen them from the street of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them when the Philistines had slain Saul in Gilboa, and brought them from thence the bones of Saul," or brought up from thence the bones of Saul, "and the bones of Jonathan, his son. And they gathered the bones of them that were hanged." So now they got 9 skeletons. "And the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, buried they in the country of Benjamin and Zelah, in the sepulcher of Kish, his father. And they performed all that the king commanded. After that, God was entreated for the land." So the judgment is over. The famine is over. Now this woman and her sacrifice and her faithfulness brought the attention of David and warranted some action by him on her behalf. And I want to just remember Rizpah a little bit this morning. What a woman she was. The Bible gives her sort of an unflattering title. It just calls her Saul's concubine. You know, concubinage isn't the same as marriage. Oriental rulers would have women that they cohabited with for the purpose of bearing a lot of heirs, so that their line couldn't be easily exterminated. You only got one son, kill him, the line's over with. You got 80 sons, it's hard to kill them all, there's still an heir to the throne. That's the purpose of concubinage, but it's only for mass reproduction. But concubine or not, this woman had a noble spirit. You know, it's a lot more to being a person of great character and great virtue. Matter of fact, it has almost nothing to do with your income level, with your ancestry, with what neighborhood you grew up in, or what kind of home you lived in, what kind of clothes you wear, what kind of makeup and hairstyle you wear. It has a whole lot more to do with the matters of the heart than it does with the matters of the appearance, or the matters of what level of society you're familiar. This great woman, this woman of noble spirit, builds herself a little tent out of sackcloth up there just underneath those 7 bodies hanging on the gallows trees. 7 gruesome bodies swinging in the air. If I'm reading it correctly, 7 months she stays and watches through them, or watches over them. Through the roasting months of the harvest, you know, August, it's still hot. September, it's still quite warm. On into the fall, October, November, the strong winds from the north begin to blow the leaves down off the trees, but the bodies remain there, stark and hideous, dangling and swinging and grinning and creaking. Right on through the winter, she keeps her vigil. December, January, February, shivering in her little tent, or running out once in a while to protect the bodies from hungry varmints that are in search of anything to eat in those cold months. Vultures and ravens and other scavengers take every opportunity to swoop down and rip off a morsel from the rotting carcass, but she chases them away every time. You understand, this is a woman who for months now has been living out in the open. She hasn't been to the beauty parlor. She hasn't had her nails done. She hasn't had a chance to change her clothes. Her hair is disheveled and her face is sunburned and windburned. And there she is. She stands up to the jackals at night, maybe even chases off a bear or two. And this is no hero in some kind of a medieval epic. Some knight on a great steed with an enchanted sword and magical armor going out to slay a dragon and rescue a damsel. This is just an ordinary woman fighting to protect 7 dead bodies from the beasts of the earth that would come along and just feast on them. And the end finally comes with the rain there in verse number 10. If I was a painter, I would try to depict it, but it'd be pretty ghastly. 7 corpses swaying in the pale moonlight. Over there's a jackal crouching at the feet of that gray-haired old mother while she's swinging a crude staff, a stick, maybe something like that, some vulture trying to pick the meat off the bones, and there she is. While she's trying to beat that thing back, here's this jackal, and she's fighting them both at once. A little gray-haired mama. It's an open buffet. And nobody here needs me to tell them why she did it. She did it out of love. Unconquerable love for her own dear children. While I can't paint you a picture of it, we can reflect a little bit on the story as it's written. And what does it bring to mind? Well, I think the first thing that we want to remember Rizpah for, we want to remember Rizpah when we get tired of watching over our children. Rizpah protected them when they were grown and even after they were dead. And it's not a hard thought to follow that we ought to be doing the same thing for ours while they're young and still alive. It's in the parent's nature and it's the parent's duty to protect the children. And you understand here this morning that there's a devouring monster that isn't just drooling over their bodies, while that's probably true, but even more importantly, he's drooling over their souls. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse number 8 says, "Be sober and be vigilant, for your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour." And that includes your children. If there's anybody who ought to be standing in the gap and fighting back the enemy and taking the risks to do what it takes, see to it that their children are protected, it ought to be Christian parents. Not only is there the roaring lion, but there's some wicked little birds that have this thing about them that whenever the seed of the Word of God is sown in the world, they love to swoop down and snatch it up and carry it away before it has a chance to take root and bear any good fruit. And you know what, folks, I got to say, sometimes I think that saved people in Bible-believing churches are their assistants rather than their opponents. I have to make everybody mad once in a while. Somebody's bound to get mad along. The industry that produces stuff for your teenagers has names for them. And they're not very flattering. You know what they refer to teenage boys? I'm talking about the clothing industry and the music industry. MTV, VH1, The Gap, Abercrombie & Fitch. All those out. Their name for a teenage boy is mook. That's what they call them, mooks. That's what they refer to them as. That's the internal industrial name for a teenage. You know what a mook is? A mook is a testosterone-driven, sexually obsessed, perpetual adolescent. That's what I say. Preacher called my boy. I didn't call him a mook. I call him a child of God and expect to live like one. The people that call him mooks are the people making stupid looking shorts. The people calling him a mook are the ones that make stupid looking shirts and stupid looking hats and all the stupid looking bracelets and necklaces and shoes and all the other goofy looking stuff. That's what they call them, mooks. They got no respect for your kid. It's just something to get his money. You know what they call your daughters? They call them midriffs. That's their name for them. I didn't invent that name. I didn't say, preacher, call my daughter a midriff. I didn't call your daughter a midriff. I told her she was a Christian and dad told her she ought to look like a lady. They're the ones that tell them expose their belly buttons, wear their tights so top you can leave nothing to the imagination. Shorts haven't got enough material in them to wad a shotgun. Midriffs. You know what they call a young man who works in a clothing store in a mall? A mall queen. I didn't make it. So I didn't make it up. They did. I don't know what you watch. You know, I don't know what you do. I don't know what you listen. I don't know what kind of research you do, but you check me out. I am not lying to you. Do your own research. Go on the internet and look around for a while. Be careful where you go. But their opinion of your, you know, they think that your son is a completely sexually obsessed perpetual adolescent who's interested in nothing more than having a good time, and that your daughters are no better. You know what? If I was you, I'm not going to start swinging this thing out here. It's a little bit bigger. It's not exactly the one I want, but I mean, I'd be knocking some stuff over. What else? You know what I can't understand about some of you people? Is who you're swinging at. I'm not the one you have to worry about. Preacher said, oh, preacher shouldn't have said that about you. Preacher shouldn't have said that to you. Preacher shouldn't have picked on you. I'm not the ones trying to get him in bed. I'm not the one that's encouraging him to have group sex. I'm not the one that's putting a bunch of stuff, a bunch of pornography in a catalog and selling it to him so they have the idea that it's cool. I'm not the one that's giving them a bunch of sensual music, make them act like animals. You know, and they like it, and so I preach against it, and you're mad at me. It kind of it just staggers the imagination. You want your daughters knocked up? You want your sons to be responsible for an unborn child, maybe pay for an abortion? You want that? Instead of swinging at Hollywood, instead of swinging at Nashville, oh boy, that went good. Guess it's over now. Nothing left. Beg your pardon? Yeah, still a baseball bat. Do good. Oh, if that thing ever got out of my hand, it'd be over. But you... That's what you ought to be doing. When they start coming, you understand those girls down at the mall? Got enough paint on them to cover a battleship, enough powder to blow it up. Exposing their legs, exposing their cleavage. I mean, coming on sensual and hedged and strong. Forward, strange women. And listen, they don't have to be in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s. Look at strange women, 12 and 13 years old. But you think it's cute because they like your boy. You think it's cute because some mook likes your daughter. Oh, that's a feather in your hat. They're attractive to the opposite sex. Yeah, but you don't understand. There's a beast in there. Your job's to stand back and stand there and fight it back. You can't have my daughter. You can't have my son. And again, what's mystifying to me is Baptist people that get mad at the guy who's trying to fight your battle for you, and you're encouraging the enemy. Remember Rizpah. When you get tired of fighting for your children, the time to protect your children from the devouring beast is right now. From the ones, not when they're dead already, then the cow's already left the barn, you know, but there are people who would lure your children away to do evil right now today. I'm not the enemy of any young man in this church. I'm not the enemy of any young woman in this church. That girl at the mall with the heavy eyeshadow and the low-rise jeans and the five rings in her ear is a lot more of a threat to your boy than I am. That boy with a fast car and a pocket full of money, a charming smile, knows how to talk to a girl, knows how to make her feel good and important and special. He's a lot more threat to your daughter than I am. But I'll tell you what's worse than that is the professing Christian girl or the professing Christian boy who has the right appearance on the outside, but there's still an evil man or a strange woman on the inside. That's an even more dangerous thing than the obvious. Men seem to take it a whole lot less alarm when I sound the alarm for their daughters than moms do when I sound the alarm for their sons. You know, I don't think a man could have done what this woman did. I'm a man. I think I understand what a man would have done. A man would have said, forget the law, forget David, forget God, forget the whole thing. I'm cutting their corpses down and burying them. Nobody's going to stop me. He snuck out there in the middle of the night with a couple of his friends, and he'd have taken care of business. He'd have defied God, and he defied the government, he defied everybody else, cut those corpses down. That's the way a man would have done it. But only a woman could have done what she did. She went ahead and bowed to the decree. But then she kept up that long watch, day and night, night and day, protecting the bones of her children. I don't know. You know, it takes a little effort to keep after them when they're little. It takes a little effort to keep after them when they're in school. It takes a little effort to keep after them once they get their driver's license. I mean, it just takes time, and it takes effort, and it takes constant vigilance. But the moment that baby cries the first time there in the hospital room, or at home if you're fortunate enough to do it that way. But once they draw their first breath, you have a 24-hour-a-day job to make sure that you know who they're with. You know what they're doing. You know whether they're obeying or whether they're rebelling, and you're going to correct their behavior when it's not right. You can't just say, well, I've got to talk to this person. I don't know where my kids are. I don't know what they're doing, but I'm sure they're not getting into any trouble. They're born in sin. They're sinners by nature. And you have to know where they are, and you have to know what they're doing, and you have to know who they're with, and they have to know when they're expected to be home. And it is a constant vigil over their souls. My oldest daughter is 20, and as far as I'm concerned, she's not leaving home unless she's living in a dormitory in a Christian college someplace. She's not leaving home until she's got a ring on her finger. Two of them. Why? Because it's my job. They've understood it from as early as they can understand. No boys unless dad meets them first. No even thinking about dating until we're in college. And then again, it's not really this serial dating this one, dating that one. But there's got to be some serious interest before we even start having a social life with these people. You understand? And say, well, you know, that you're a dad and that's a daughter. Well, this is a woman and these are a son. You find out your son. You ought to know enough about your sons to know if they're interested in the girl, not just know the girl they're interested in when they tell you. You ought to know enough about your daughters to know the boy, to know that they're interested in the boy, not just know the boy when they finally tell you that they're interested in somebody. Where are they going? Who are they with? Who are they meeting when they're there? What is the relationship they're having with? A lot of stuff goes on in secret. The reason it's secret is because there's not enough vigilance. Remember, Rizpah, when you get tired of watching and keeping a vigil over your children, because there's never a moment when out of nowhere, some beast, some monster, some scavenger, going to show up and wanting to pull a piece of them off. My wife, this is half the message, the other half probably won't get preached. My wife, when time taught the high school girls Sunday school class, and she did this thing on your heart, you know, and took, what was it, little balloons? Little cupcakes, yeah. You know, heart-shaped cupcakes. Gave me your heart-shaped cupcake. You said, you know, this is yours. You start passing it around, you start giving a piece to this one, giving a piece to that one, giving a piece to that, before you know it's all eaten up. Those girls still remember that lesson. And most of the girls that were taught that lesson, by the way, they not only remembered it up here, most of them have kind of lived by it. They've not given their heart to this boy and that boy, piece here, piece here, piece there. They've held on to that thing. And then when the right boy came along, they were able to give them the whole thing. That's how it's supposed to be. But you understand, if it's your job to see to it that that's the way it happens. No teenager has the wisdom. No teenager has the discernment. No teenager has the understanding. Some are better than others. Some are more mature than others. Some have more convictions than others. But none of them are completely safe unless mom and dad are standing in the gap. See, there's some boy wants a piece of your daughter's body and a piece of her heart. And when he gets his piece, that's all he cares about. He's gotten it. He's moving on. There's some girl wants a piece of your son's heart. Probably wants a piece of his body. The girls these days are just as forward as the boys. Wants a piece of your son's heart. Wants a piece of his body. And when they're done, they're moving on. They got more experiments they want to have. You understand? But what you're doing is you're letting those monsters just rip them apart a shred at a time. It's your job to protect them. Maybe you can't afford to put them in a Christian school. Maybe there's other things. But you understand, that's when it's time for vigilance. That's when it's time for prayer. That's when it's time for asking questions. That's when it's time for dropping in on the phone calls. That's when it's time to invade their privacy. That's when it's time to see what's stuffed underneath the mattress or buried underneath the socks. That's when it's time to see what's in the glove compartment or underneath the cover in the trunk. That's when it's time to find out. Because you have to be vigilant. Because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walking about seeking whom he may devour. And this poor woman, so much more godliness and so much more character and so much more love and so much more determination and so much more consideration than any of us would probably ever be able to live up to. It's never easy to watch. It's never. Not only is it not always, it's never easy to watch. I don't know many women who could have endured it. I mean, think about it at night. A lone, gray-haired woman with seven corpses swinging in the breeze over her. You and I, we'd beat feet in a hurry. But there she sits, watching, sleeplessly watching, mournfully watching, on and on and on, watching while the stars are out and watching when the sun creeps slowly from horizon to horizon. Nobody came to relieve her. Not at night, not in day. It's not easy. Rezbah had a hideous vision above her head. I can imagine well-meaning people passing by and trying to get her to leave it. Say, oh, come on, Rezbah. I think you've done this long enough, and do you understand that the appeal would have been to self and self-pity? Poor you. This is taking a lot out of you. You don't need to do this anymore. You've paid your price. You know, there's nothing left that you can do. This can't go on forever. But you know, the real Christian doesn't have any kind of traffic with that kind of motivation. The real Christian says, I'm not letting go. I can hear her say, I can't. I can't do it. For the love of God, I can't do it. I won't leave them. I won't leave them alone. These are my children. How can you ask me to do that? How can you ask me to just walk away and let the wolves and the vultures get them? All you see is gruesomeness and horror. But I see my very life in my children. She said, if it was up to me, I'd have died instead of them. But since I can't, all I can do is protect them now. If every one of us was as careful as Rezbah to protect our children from the beast of rebellion, we'd call it revival. If every one of us was as careful as Rezbah to protect our marriages, I mean, there's so much here I haven't touched on, but if we were as careful as Rezbah to protect our marriages from the beast of selfishness, we'd call it revival. If every one of us was as careful as Rezbah to protect our church from the scavengers of gossip and grumbling and cliques and murmuring and apathy and indifference and slander, we'd call it revival. If every one of us was as careful as Rezbah to protect our minds from the rotten, putrid, filth-eating vermin of lust and envy and discontentment and self-pity, we'd call it revival. If every one of us was as careful as Rezbah to watch over one another in prayer, when we can see that somebody's out in the open, when we can see somebody's exposed to the enemy, when we can see somebody is being subject to temptation, we can see somebody is being pursued, if we would pray for them, if we would watch over them and pray, if we would get alone or get with a brother and say, oh God, get a hold of so-and-so, protect them from themselves. They don't even know what they're doing. They're in danger. But God, drive off the enemy. If we would do that, we'd call it revival. I can't stop anybody's gossip. I can't stop anybody's complaining tongue, but I can pray for them. I can't stop a woman from infidelity against her husband, but I can pray for her. I can't hold back a man from bowing before the demon gods of alcohol and gambling and tobacco and pornography, but I can pray for him. I can watch for him. And shouldn't that be our daily routine as Christians, to watch and to weep for those that have lost their ability to defend themselves? I'd be glad for any help. If I was a parent watching for my children, I'd be glad for any help. Then watch and watch some more. Jesus said, "What I say unto all, watch." We didn't read the text of Matthew for God, but that's what Jesus said. Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Don't let any wolf or buzzard enter into your soul and pollute your relationship with the Holy Ghost and your fellowship with Jesus Christ. Don't let them into your marriage. Don't let them into your family. Don't let them get your kids. Don't let them into your church. Watch. Don't let any beloved brother or sister in the Lord be torn apart by vultures and vermin. Don't let any young person, don't let any teenager, don't let any young adult be torn apart by the vultures and the vermin. Watch! When you think about quitting, remember Rizpah. Let's pray. Father in heaven, if we could have every head bowed, every eyes closed, and nobody looking around, if you'd stand so others can get out. Holy Spirit of God, I pray that you press these truths on our hearts. Lord, help us to watch and to worship and to watch and to suffer and to watch and to serve with Jesus until the rains come. For 7 months, a few months, as you watched over these dead bodies, Lord, 18, 20, 25 years maybe, and then even after they're married, we watch. Lord, may we watch the things that we love. I don't know what those seven represent, Lord. I didn't even toyed with the idea. They could be one represent the children, one represent the church, one represent the marriage, one represent the nation, one represent the community. Who knows, Lord? Probably anything you think people want to make of it, Lord. But the point is, there's more than one thing that we have to watch. And Lord, what a great commendation this woman is. What a commendation she has from you. What a great example she is to us, oh God. So mixed up, so confused, so upside down and backwards sometimes in our thinking. Lord, please forgive me for where I've allowed these ravenous beasts, Lord, into my mind or my marriage. I haven't been watchful and let them have access to my children, my brethren, my church, my ministry, my fellowship, my companions, Lord, whatever, Lord. You know, God, there's places where every one of us would have to say, wasn't watching. Wasn't watching, and that came in. Lord, I wasn't watching. I was watching something I shouldn't, or watching somewhere else, or confused about what I was supposed to be against. And Lord, please, make us watchful. Lord, Christian young people now heading off to colleges soon, choosing careers, getting to the place where they're picking their partners for their life. Oh God, help us to watch. Make sure they don't wind up in the wrong place. Make sure they don't wind up with the wrong one. Make sure they're not involved in the wrong things. Lord, help us to not let any vulture, any vermin come along and rip off a piece of our kids. Lord, let us deliver them intact. All these other things. God, please help us. While heads are bowed, eyes are closed, and nobody's looking around, I like the piano to play.
more verse. Just wait for just a second. Travis, how many more weeks are you going to be with us? About 2 more weeks. Again, Travis graduated medical school. He is Travis Taylor DO, right? And we're congratulating him on that. Spent some time with him yesterday. And been just great. You may not have gotten to know them in the 3 years they've been here. 4 years, right? 4 years. Because medical school is pretty demanding. And he's been going to medical school and working too, and so, but he's going to be transferred to Dayton and be working in a medical military hospital down there, Dayton, with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And so, make sure in the next couple of weeks get by and let them know you love them. You're going to miss them. I'm certainly going to miss them. They really have been very supportive of me personally, as you know, just again, they've been involved in a lot of ministries and things because of the demands of medical school, but. But I can't think of anybody that's been more personally supportive of me, and I really appreciate them. And of course, God has plans for him. He's got a long way to go before he's able to get to the mission field, about 11 years yet before he's free from his commitment to the military, but with the objective of being a medical missionary. That's the direction he's headed. Sometimes it takes a while to get to the things God has for us, but again, I just really appreciate them, and I look forward to what God's going to do with them. And I'd like Travis to dismiss us in prayer this morning.